Mr. Seibert, Reel 9. We were talking about your time with the 2nd 5th Sherwood Foresters in Italy during the fighting in August, September, in the Gothic line. We're taking things sort of incident-based rather than day-by-day. What's the next thing that you remember, or one of the next things you remember of the fighting?
Well, there was one incident which remains firmly in my mind. It was with a lad that was killed. I think it was possibly near Germano, but I'm not quite sure. It might have been the action itself, but it's so long ago I can't recall exactly where this incident took place. But Joe Acton, his name was in a, we formed up, and Joe was in a line in front of me, about 20 or 30 feet in front of me. They were moving off to start the attack. And he turned and came back to me, and he took a ring from his finger and gave it to me, and he said that his wife had given him the ring, and that he was not going to come out of this action, he was going to be killed. These were virtually his words. And I more or less told him to cheer up, not be an idiot, and to take his ring back. But anyway, he wouldn't. He said he would be killed, and insisted that I keep the ring.
What was his attitude? Was he nervy or...?
No, quite calm. Quite calm. Was not showing the slightest bit of nervousness. And he asked me to make sure that his wife received the ring. Anyway, we moved off and his line went first. And I could hear the spandos going all around us, some in the distance, some quite near. And the forward line moved off through a small belt of trees, and again I could hear the spandos firing. We followed on, and we came to a field, and I could see several bodies lying in the field. We kept on moving forward, and the first body I passed was Joe. The others had gone to ground and were firing at a farmhouse, which was maybe 100 yards or so away. We kept on going and cleared the farmhouse. And this may have been the beginning of the slopes of Germano, or the Italian pronunciation, I can't pronounce it. But later on, I heard from one of the chaps in Joe's platoon that when the Spando opened up, that most of them went straight to ground and survived, but Joe just stood there and was killed. But the reason that he didn't go to ground with the others is just beyond me. I don't know. I can't know what goes in people's minds. I think that he'd more or less given up his spirit. I don't, you know, you can't judge these sort of things, what goes through people's minds. I think there comes a time when the chaps became so exhausted, both physically and mentally, that they no longer cared what happened to them. And this is possibly what the reason for this particular incident. But anyway...
So then get the date. It's Private Joe Ackling, A-C-K-L-I-N-G. Look that up. What about the ring? Did you get it back to the...
Well, I gave it... next time we went back for a rest, I gave it to the quartermaster. What was his name? And I told him what had happened, and he said that he would see the ring. I went back to Joe's wife, but I spoke to Fred Markham a few weeks ago, and he said he didn't remember the incident at all. But I suppose it was one of many. because when they moved forward, it was always a chilling sight to see them, the supply trucks putting white crosses on the trucks.
Well, what did that mean?
Well, they were going to, they were preparing for people being killed and had the cross to put there.
The burial crosses.
The burial crosses. Yeah, it was always a little bit sent a chill through you. Yeah.
Now you're not sure that's Germano or not, but what else do you remember about Germano?
Well, Germano in particular. As again, I said to you previously, I cannot with certainty say that this particular place was Germano, but there were so many bodies there, and it was such a tough battle in that area that I think it could well have been. But the 25 pounders had put down a barrage of stuff, as it was known, before we moved forward from the start line. And what particularly remains in my mind is as we marched up the slope, because that's literally what you did, was just to move forward. And the whole of the hillside was covered with small shell holes from the 25 pounds. They didn't make a large hole. And in the middle of the hill was a line of bodies stretching around the hill. And in some cases there were small groups of them. But I believe what had happened was that the barrage had been in two phases, one starting at the top of the hill and coming down, and one at the bottom of the hill going up. That is what appeared to have happened. And there, on the forward slope of the hill, there were foxholes, small slip trenches, and the Germans had obviously been occupying them. And my opinion is that the barrage was so intense that those higher up the hill left as it came down and started to run down the hill, and those lower down the hill started to go back, and they were caught in the middle by both barrages coming together. That is what appeared to have happened, and they were just lying in a long line around the side of the hill. But when we eventually cleared the slope and got to the top there, I went over there onto the reverse slope of the hill, and there were a number of tunnels going into the reverse slope, and each of these tunnels must have been about, oh, I should think 20 or 30 feet long, and finished up with a T-junction. So anyone, they could have just stayed in those tunnels until attack started, and irrespective of how many fighter bombers, how many shells came over, they were completely safe. Nothing could touch them. And as soon as they saw an attack was starting, they would come out. And they also had recesses, which were just like almost like a sentry box built into the side of the hill, where one or two men could go into it. And a lot of these recesses, they were corns, strips of corn were covering the fronts. And you pulled these aside, and in most of them there was a body sitting there, or was just stuffed in. And they must have used these to push the dead into, to keep, presumably, to not to break up the morale of the others, seeing bodies about. But by then they'd obviously been in there at least a day, because the weather was very hot, and they were all decomposing. they must have been there. The body would start to swell up within a few hours in the sun and get turned black. But these were swarming with maggots. All the side bags were absolutely filled with them. But that particular occasion, we just covered them up again and left them. And then we must have buried them later on, buried them at the foot of the hill. And then, a few days later, or a week back later, we must have returned, because I saw our company cooks digging them up, looking for souvenirs. Doesn't sound possible, does it? That's all I remember about that particular place.
Now, one thing is, you had a camera with you, didn't you? Could you tell us a bit about that? Because were you supposed to have a camera?
No, camera wasn't allowed, but unfortunately, films were very hard to get. And I think that during the time we were in the Gothic line, that perhaps I might have only had perhaps two rolls of film. So there was a very limited number of photographs that I could take. Then later on, the camera was stolen. By somebody or other, but I think after that I must have had one when we went to Greece, because I took some photographs in Greece. But after that, it was probably stolen.
Now, any other actions you remember?
I'll tell you what I do remember at that particular place, Germano. That there were quite a few that we called them Turco men, and they were chaps from the Russian army that had been captured by the Germans and were put into the German army, or possibly in complete units. But they were mostly quite big fellows, and the story was that the Germans would leave them behind and tell them that the English or the British didn't take prisoners, and if they left their positions, the Germans would shoot them anyway. That was the story. How true or not, I don't know. But they certainly put up very tough resistance. I only came across two that were alive, and this is, funnily enough, a story I've heard repeated. And I very much, well, leave it at that. But on the occasion that I saw two of them alive, we'd occupied or taken a farmhouse, and I forget whether it was the sergeant or Corporal Smith said, check in the haystack. And I was on one side of the haystack, sticking it into the hay with my bayonet, and I heard people shouting on the other side. And walked around there, and all I did was Tom Reynolds. I'm not quite certain. And there was a hole underneath the haystack, and they pulled out two of these Turco men, and they were dressed in civilian clothes. But to me, what had been roaring with laughter was that the Italians that mostly were quite small. And these two Turco men were 6 footers. their jackets came up to their elbows nearly, and the trousers were almost up to their knees. And there were the pair of them, as yellow as canaries, saying they were Italian civilians. I laughed over that for days. But they were the only two that I ever saw alive. All the rest were dead, and there were quite a lot of them. But again, I was speaking to Tom, and he doesn't even remember them. That's strange, isn't it?
What's the next major action here? Is it Cassina or was it anything Cousina or however you pronounce it? Or was there some more before that?
There must have been quite a few before that. There was a place called Verrucchio, but there was nothing particularly important there as far as an action was concerned. It was only stays in my memory because we marched, and I use the word march, we did march on a road which was leading up to the town. And on that particular occasion, I was the last man in the platoon. And this is why it stays in my memory, that as we were moving forward, somebody would do something, perhaps adjust the pack or something like that, small arms, something, and I would move forward one. And then the chap in front of me again, perhaps his gaiter was becoming loose, so he would adjust his gaiter and I would move forward for another one. And in the end, I was leading the platoon. But on this road, I thought, well, this is a double. Until I think it was Corporal Smith was on the side. I said, the road's clear. I said, no, mind. He said, yes, there is, because they'd excavated very small holes in the road, about a foot deep, and the mines were by the side. And I said, they hadn't had time to put the mines in. Corporal Smith was by the side of me. He said, they're there. And it was a pure bluff. Further along, you could see where they'd put a mine in and covered it with dust and rubble. And that road was well and truly mined. I believe later on some tanks were pulled on it. But anyway, we marched into the... through the gate, I went through the gate, and fortunately the town was completely empty. We did the usual sort of stunt of making sure by throwing grenades in and firing through the windows, etc., but there was no opposition, the town was empty. But I later found out that only a short while before we arrived there, that the Germans had shot quite a few civilians in the square. That was in one place. Where else was there? There was, again, I think it was at the spot where I told you that earlier that we had an Italian as a prisoner who was later shot, but we had previously taken quite a few prisoners there and had them in an outbuilding somewhere, about 40 or 50 of them, and the shell dropped in there. Fortunately, no British were hurt, but quite a few of the Germans were. But you're speaking about the Cosina or Cosina. I think that was possibly one of the, or yes, the worst incident probably. Weather must have been getting bad by then, I think very bad, because there was mud everywhere. And our platoon officer, lots of the time we didn't have any platoon officer. They seemed to come and go, but on this particular occasion, we had a chap that I knew had been a school teacher. I don't know how I knew, but I did know. And we watched him over the weeks gradually deteriorate. And
in what way?
Getting more and more. We used the term bomb happy, but battle fatigue. And he endeavoured to show us on the map where we were going, the objective. We never did know, or I didn't anyway. We were all crouched up around him, and he had this map in his hand, and I didn't know what he was saying. He was just mumbling away to himself, but he got the map upside down, and I think it was a Corporal Heron. There was a Corporal Heron and a Sergeant Heron. I think it was a Corporal Heron who leaned over and turned the map so he was looking at it the right way. And when we started off, we were supposed to be following behind a 25-pounder barrage. I can't remember now how far behind it we were. But and of course it was night, or during the night. They usually timed these attacks to take place so you would get there just before dawn. And anyway, he led us forward, and he walked straight into the barrage. We were following, Michael Sen was following behind him. I think we were the leading section at the time. So we just blindly followed after him into this barrage. The ground must have been very, very soft and muddy, because though the explosions of shells were quite near, nobody was hurt. They were burying themselves in the mud. Then the Germans opened up. So we've got two barrages coming down on us. We bring our own barrage, and the Germans are firing as well. So it got heavier and heavier, and still he went forward into it. And we were the leading section of the platoon, and the chap behind me, he banged on my shoulder. I looked around, he said, "There's no one behind us." So I think there were about six of us following this lieutenant.
What had happened to the others?
Don't know. Well, it was a common thing to happen. Very common. That sections and units and companies would get lost. Where they got lost and how they got lost, I'm not quite sure. But you would often start off an attack. Well, I say often, it happened too frequently to be a coincidence, and find out that you would finish up with perhaps a dozen of you. Where everybody else was, I don't know. This I'm talking about at night. But it was very easy to get lost at night anyway. But it finished up with about six of us following this lieutenant. And we eventually approached a farmhouse. By that time, the lieutenant had disappeared as well. He was lost. And the shelling was so intense that we just fell down by the side of a haystack and took cover there. We were lying in a half circle around the haystack. A chap by the name of Venables, it must have been Venables who said there's no one behind us. Venables was lying behind me. And at one point, he got I felt his hands on my ankles, and he put my boots over his head. And I was quite indignant about it. But I was all for rushing into the farmhouse, but Corporal Smith, he was a good, marvellous chap, Smith, you know. We got to take our time. It's in effect, he said, we've got to see what's happening. And he said there might be Jerry's in there. So there was a lull, and he said, right. And we all got up and dashed into the farmhouse. It was still dark. There were a few fires going, but I suppose that was a certain amount of light somewhere. But we got into the farmhouse. It was pitch black inside. And Smith said to crawl around that and find the layout of the place. So I was on all fours, crawling around on the floor and put my hand out, put my hand on the face. Cold as ice. I knew there was somebody dead there. So I said, I called to Smith, there's somebody here, he's dead there. And so it was all quiet. Gradually dawn came. The dead chap was a British soldier. And we picked him up and put him on the table there so we could go through his pocket, see if we could identify him. And I don't think we could, we might have found identification, I don't remember now, but the Duke of Wellington regiment comes to mind, and usually when something comes to mind like that, you can be fairly certain that that chap was from the Duke of Wellington regiment. How he came to be in that house, farmhouse, nobody could fathom out. Whether he'd been wounded and taken there by the Germans or not, I don't know. But certainly this fellow was a British soldier in that isolated farmhouse. Gradually people started to come into the farmhouse. It was getting light then. And we could see that the Germans were occupying another farmhouse about 200 yards forward of us. We had no officers at all. Sergeant Herring appeared, started to size up the situation, and said that he would go back to report our positions. Somebody else appeared with a 48 set. That was a small fat radio that usually the somebody accompanying an officer would batman or something like that would carry, and they would have a telephone in that. This chap tried to contact the headquarters. At that point, I believe it, somebody said there's people, or there's something outside. It was very misty. We all turned out. It was the finished up with two lines of British soldiers facing each other. It was the battle patrol from S Company out looking to see what had happened. So by the time they got into the farmhouse, it was standing room only. The fellow on the 48 set was trying to get through to headquarters, eventually managed to find regimental HQ. And Colonel Welchman came onto the line, and the fellow with the radio was trying to tell him that we hadn't any officers, and he was saying our sun rays are missing, which the sun ray was whatever officer was in charge. So he was, Welchman was trying to identify which sun rays were missing, and of course the fellow with the radio couldn't say, well, it's Major Tullock was missing, and there was a Lieutenant Lawrence there missing. And so he was saying, it's our, I think it was our sun ray major is missing, our sun ray major, and our sun ray minor. And this was, it was most strange.